Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
The European Union's climate change service, Copernicus, says last month was the hottest March ever recorded. It's the 10th month in a row that a new air temperature record has been set. The March average is 21.07 Celsius. Disadvantaged children who live near a Sure Start centre have achieved better GCSEs, but the Institute for Fiscal Studies warns that the current government's family hubs are unlikely to have the same impact. Sarah Catan is research fellow at the IFS and co-author of the report.
If the government is interested in promoting the outcomes of children, and especially of disadvantaged children, then these type of policies of really working at integrating services to support families with young children really need to be part of the answer.
And the inquiry into the post office IT scandal resumes later. The campaigner Alan Bates is due to give evidence. He'll be followed by senior figures from the post office and Fujitsu in the coming weeks. That's the latest from Radio News Hub. I'm Stephen Davis.
Why do I race for life? For my very own Bal Babe, who calls rain liquid sunshine, whose presence is like one big hug, a treasure hunter in the charity shops and a fighter through her treatment. She believed in me before I believed in myself. That's my sister from another mister. Her name is Viv, and I'm racing for her.
No matter how cancer affects us, life is worth racing for. Sign up to your local event at raceforlife.org by the 29th of April to get 30% off entry. In partnership with headline sponsor Standard Life.
Coming up, Africa in Focus.
It's the new Colourful Drive with me, Mac, from 4 till 7 p.m. So that means you have me for a whole 3 hours. How do you feel about that?
Good.
I hope so. Unacceptable. Listen, it's Burner Boy. Okay, up next is going to be the Colourful Radio Record of the Week. The new Colourful Drive with me, Mac, from 4 till 7 p.m. Current affairs, Record of the Week, the music and you.
Come on, the Blues! We're in white, Einstein.
Whoops, Sandy League foot is so British.
Which reminds me, smart meters could help Britain create a future where we're less reliant on imported gas.
All right.
They help us manage our energy use, which improves the balance of supply and demand. So we could use more wind and solar energy from Britain.
Help Britain create a future that's less reliant on imported gas. Search Get a Smart Meter today. Eligibility may vary. Consumer action required.
Hey, yo. Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
Africa in Focus.
Colorful
Radio.
Good morning, good evening, depending on the time zone you are listening to us from. Welcome to Africa in Focus. I'm your host, Julius Baluto.
From wherever you are, join us in this great conversation. Did you know that education is a right and not a privilege? And then again, if education is a right and not a privilege, what are the challenges that has been there? Why do we still have children who have not gone to school? Why do we even have grown-ups who missed out on education? If education is a right and not a privilege, what are the challenges? What are the issues? Please join us this wonderful, wonderful morning for another great conversation, as I'm going to be speaking to a great personality and a great servant of the world, Fatou Bensouda. Is this your first Africa Summit in the London School of Economics, or have you been here before?
No, actually, I do recall that I have come to a few events at the London School of Economics. I'm not sure whether it was the Africa Summit, but I've done lectures here, and I've also come to some events in my former life as chief prosecutor of the ICC.
Oh, that's
so brilliant. This is not the first time. Perhaps it's the first Africa Summit. I'm not sure, but definitely not the first time at the LSE.
Yeah. The day, how has it been? I mean, when we see what's happening, what great conversations all around.
Yeah. No, I think.
What's your thinking of it?
I think it's a great day. I mean, the event itself, which, as you said, is the 10th year now, is quite important in the sense that it is bringing together you know, people who can discuss matters especially that are affecting the continent at the moment. And I had the privilege to be invited to come and discuss the issue of the right to education, looking at the legal instruments that are there, which have been there for a long time now, such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Convention on Political, Economic and Social, and many other conventions, even at the regional one, the African Charter for Human and People's Rights. So we're discussing these international instruments, and also at the same time, we were discussing how they are being implemented in individual countries. And as I said, the focus was on Africa. And also what are the challenges that are being faced in implementing those, especially when it comes to the legal instruments, but also the issue of accountability, the issue of accountability not only for government but also for non-state actors. So it was quite an interesting discussion that we had.
Just over the top, quick, in terms of these pieces of legislation, of course, to our listeners, they may want to know. What does that mean? What are they? Just in a quick version, because some people don't know. Education is a right and not a privilege.
Indeed. In all these instruments that I've mentioned, if you even take the Universal Declaration of Human Rights or your Convention on Political and Social Cultural Rights, or you take the one on African Charter on Human and People's Rights, and also the Children's, the Convention on the Rights of the Child. They are there, and they have been specifically defined as the right. They are emphasizing that education is a right. Is a right to all, and that governments have responsibility to ensure that they make sure these rights, you know, that people have, especially children, that it is implemented fully. But of course, you have seen that over the years we've made progress. At the domestic level, you see that there are governments who already have that in their constitutions, which is always the fundamental law of the land. So it is there, and there are other national legislations as well that are trying to implement, but and even if not to implement those as such, but also to have something, some domestic legislation that would make sure that they implement the right to education. But indeed, there are challenges, and we know that the challenges are there. We've discussed it during the panel discussion, and challenges such as resources. To be able to implement those legislations. Challenges such as outdated laws are even there, which it's difficult to align them with these international instruments. And constraints such as the issue of inclusion. You know, inclusion, making sure that this right is accessible to all, despite your status. Accessible to those who are disabled. In fact, I like to call them who are otherwise abled, because differently able, and also the fact that gender, the issue of gender, we know that it permeates the society in Africa, other societies as well. But since we are talking about Africa, the issue of gender inclusion for the right to education is a big issue, and many countries are still struggling with that. So it is time that we put that conversation on the table and to talk about it as much as possible and include everyone, because non-state actors also have a role to play, include everyone and make sure that we really discuss it and look for ways and strategies and means and goals that will follow.
Yeah, when I think politically, I see a situation in Africa whereby of course, because of politics, tribalism, corruption.
Yes.
They're always playing up when education, because education is empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the fore, politics kick in. And of course, we shared a few of that. Also, in terms of culture, when you talk about culture, you see there's a poor African farmer, but they have a daughter, and culturally, in some communities in Africa, mm-hmm. they're like, when they have a girl, mm-hmm. they're like, when she's about 14, I'll marry her off,
yeah.
to become rich,
mm-hmm.
In exchange of animals, you know, mm-hmm. what they call dowry.
Dowry, yeah.
So that another challenge. And when you talk about the customary role, mm-hmm. customary law as well, mm-hmm. which tends in a quiet way to enforce some of these practices.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about those three, what's your observation on mm-hmm. them? Is there anything we can do to deal with it?
Well, I know that a lot of work needs to be done in that regard. We know in most parts of Africa, or you cannot even say most parts, in many parts of Africa, maybe even all parts of Africa, we have this problem, we have this cultural problem. It's getting better, but it's still there. And these are the harmful traditional practices that we have in the continent, such as early child marriage. This is wrong, this should not happen. The issue of FGM. Is also another issue that we need to really deal with. At the moment in the Gambia, there is a big debate that is going on because there is a private members bill that has been brought to Parliament to repeal the law that was banning FGM. Wow. We're talking about, yes, wow. So this is happening, and the unfortunate thing about it is that there's still trying to explain it away by using religion and culture. It's no part of any religion, because it has been established that nowhere in the Quran, for instance, Gambians are mainly Muslims, 95%. So they use the Quran to say that it is religion. They are respecting religion. If you do it, we are respecting religion. But that is not the case. And I am glad that there are other voices on the continent in this debate who have come forward to say that nowhere in the Quran has it advocated for FGM. It's not there. And when it comes to culture as well, I know that there are some who practice it, but because of the health reasons that has been given, it has been extensively presented the health hazards that they face. That alone should really show that it's a harmful traditional practice and we should let it go. But unfortunately, the debate is there, and you have men who are debating and fighting over what they should cut on a female's body. This is totally wrong.
Not even involving totally women.
Not even involving
the ones
them.
Who
yes.
are normal.
Yes. Not even involving women, but them going to the extent of holding public demonstrations and all sorts of things just to cut women. So I think this is quite wrong, and I hope that in the Gambia, our members of parliament will do the right thing, National Assembly members will do the right thing and not do that. But as I said again, all of these are things, practices that in some way or the other affect education. Because there are some, indeed, who, because of this practice, sometimes they don't go back to school or they don't start school. It affects. And we have seen many have also, it's possible for people to lose their lives when they do that. So these are practices that we should show. As for early marriage, I don't see any reason or any justification why that should continue. Girls should be given the opportunity to get educated and later on in life get married. You know, most of the professional women you have today are married. And have children, have families. But if you take the child out of school as young as 15, 14, 15, to get them married, and of course they go into childbearing, they go into all sorts of domestic issues that they have to deal with, what time would they have for education? So these are things that we really need to look at, and to ensure that we do it in another way, you know, in a better way. That you will not take away the right of the girl child or the woman to education. It's important that we put our heads together. Already the progress has been made, I have to say. There are some societies where the age limit, for instance, for marriage has been raised as a result of non-state actors bringing NGOs, civil society, and ensuring that governments do the right thing.
And we share very strongly and very powerfully about young men being enlisted as children soldiers. Question is, internationally, is there a piece of legislation that disallows such practices, and is there a way to enforce, mm-hmm. to stop it?
Look, I mean, just look at the ICC statutes. In some legislations nationally, of course, I can say off the top of my head, but the ICC statute is a statute. It's an international statute in which about 124 members to the statute. And if you look at statute, the fact that any army or militia would enlist and conscript children below the age of 15 is a crime right there. It's a crime. No two ways, no two questions. And this is what led to, I think I mentioned it during my discussions, this is what led to the first case of ICC based only on the issue of child soldiers. Thomas Lubanga Dilo of the DRC was charged for enlisting and conscripting children. And if you really go into the case and you look at what children go through, children as young as 6, 7, 8, conscripted, enlisted, taken from their playgrounds, taken from their homes, taken from their schools, and enlisted into armies, given a gun, you know, and taught how to kill. This is very sad. It's a very sad situation. You are talking about a whole generation of children not knowing anything else to do but being shown how to kill. You talked about boys, because it's not only the boys.
Even
the girls. Even girls are also enlisted. And these girls are also very young. Most of the time in militia life, they are, when soldiers perform well, they are given as rewards to the soldiers to be their sex slaves. So this also happens. Girls become sex slaves. They fight in the front line. They become spies. They become cooks. They are misused and abused during this life. And as you know, when you're young, and you're made to know certain things, it's very difficult when you're old not to think that that's the thing you should do. So this is a very, very serious issue in our societies, which I believe that both the civil society and governments themselves should work together to ensure that this doesn't happen. We're handing over to those children. You know, they should be well equipped to be able to carry our countries forward. But if you bring children who only know how to kill, how to do bad things, this also affects society as a whole.
And I'm very concerned about the reflex or conditioned reflex action when they live there. They are like conditioned to live that way.
Yes. Yes, we have had, during my time at the ICC, we have had very, very sad incidents that happened with children who have been in militia and who have been in armies. There was a program by Save the Children and other international organizations to rehabilitate these children, to delist them and bring them back to society and bring them back to their families. Sometimes it was not possible to bring them back to their families because some of these militias are so ruthless that when they are conscripting these children or enlisting them or kidnapping them, abducting them, the first thing that you need to do was to kill your parents so that you have nowhere else to come to. And they give you your gun and tell you this is your father and your mother. So these are the brutal things, that are the horrendous things that are happening there. So it has an effect on society. And sometimes when you take them back to rehabilitate and take them back to families, they find it very, very difficult to adjust to that kind of life. And unfortunate incidents have happened, which I really don't like to talk about, but we have seen children that have actually killed their parents, even when they go back, because their mind is so conditioned. For instance, they tell them, someone should not say, I'm tired. You should not be tired. And we have heard incidents in which the mother says, okay, let's stop the work now in the family, let's go home because I'm tired. So the immediate reaction of the child was to turn around and hit the mother with a machete. Yeah. So it can get to that level. And also when they are in the bush being trained, they also get them used to drugs, narcotics. So sometimes most of the children that are brought back, demobilized, are addicts already, And I remember we used to have programs in which we would say that, okay, this is your, let's say, we give them a phone, and you say that this is the phone that if anything happens and you're in danger or anything, just call this number, and then there's an immediate response system, something like that. And we have had occasions in which children sell the phones because they needed to use drugs. So it's a very, very serious issue. And the impact is so deep that I just hope that, you know, we as leaders on the continent and the governments will really avert their minds to this and ensure that we preserve, you know, we help the next generation from this search.
Then what can we do? Just to lastly make an observation, I don't want to leave feeling desperate, like it's so complex that it can't be sorted. What can we do, like, to make sure there's inclusivity in education and all these wrongs are not happening?
That is right. I mean, the situation is difficult, but it's not one that we cannot solve if we have a good resolve to come together and work together and see that and have in mind that what we want to do is to ensure that this right to education is enforced, is implemented, and that those who are supposed to be doing it are also held accountable. This is where the role of civil society comes in. You know, they can actually take up these issues when they see that really this particular government is not doing anything to ensure that there is inclusivity in education. At the national level. So civil societies can come together. It is not only about giving aid, international aid, because at the end of the day, if that aid is not used properly, there is no point. It's useless. So I believe what has to be done is really to hold the government to account, put their feet to the fire, and ensure that they are also doing their responsibility. I think there was a situation in Kenya, if I can remember, where they had taken the right to education. I think, is it Sarap? I have it, but okay, let me know. Yeah, but this is what happened, and the NGO took the matter up, and it was pronounced by the court that yes, indeed, this this is a right that everybody has to enjoy. And I think from then on, it encouraged the progression in school, and more enrollment, and also reaching out to remote societies where it is extremely important to ensure that they also enjoy the right to education.
So we should not tire to challenge.
Not at all. We cannot rest on our laurels. We cannot be tired. We have to go on. We should never give up.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is Colorful Radio.
Colorful Radio.
Apparently, we learn quite a lot through the media. The media is seen to be the reflection of the society. Whichever country you go to, we learn quite a lot about culture, about country, about its people, about the makeup of their society, quite a lot about, you know, heritage, about everything. We learn quite a lot through the media. Media is a power to reckon with when it comes to people learning things, and it's been actually, in a way, criticized for giving the wrong type of knowledge, the wrong type of information. In journalism, we talk about misreporting. We talk about things being reported out of context. So what are the key issues? And if we were to talk about, again, media as a platform through which knowledge gets shared, what will be the exact situation there? And to explore this, I'm joined by Eric Gavala, who is here with me. And of course, I'll give him the chance to introduce himself. Eric Gavala, I just want you to introduce yourself to our listeners and just tell us what is it you do, and maybe top up that with the motivation. How did you get into that?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor to be here and to speak with you on this very important topic. The motherland is dear to us all. So my name is Eric Gavala, as you said. I am operations manager at African Stream. I have been there since the very beginning, as the company was being set up to where we are now. I broke down the numbers earlier when you were speaking, how much we've grown over the last year, just to show how much demand there is for this kind of content. And what kind of content do we do? So African Stream is a pan-African, anti-imperialist, digital-only media. We are focused on social media. Let me say primarily, we are on social media. Think of any platform, you'd find us there. And we like to think of ourselves as a one-stop shop for everything African, because if it's history, breaking news, geopolitics, sports, business, name it, and even entertainment. There's a new feature on the platform. Is called Instagram. It's called Remixing, and we love to do it so much because it gets people engaged with the kind of content that we do. So we not only entertain, we also inform and show people what Africa has to offer from an African perspective. That's what I do.
Question is, what kind of content? Why is it different from our usual bloggers, TikTokers, everybody on YouTubers as well? Why is it different? What makes it different?
What makes African Stream unique, and the reason why we gathered about 500 million views last year, and we are still growing, is because of the unique perspective with which we look at African matters. There has been a proliferation of news content about Africa. There was a time everyone was covering, you know, Africa is rising. There's a time everyone was saying Africa is the next frontier. However, the problem is many people regurgitate what Western media says about Africa. When you look at the wires, what people call news agencies, they are mostly Western news agencies. What African Stream tries to do is to cover the story of Africa, not just from an African perspective, but also from an anti-imperialist perspective. So the history of Africa, number one, has been erased. Number two, has been distorted to make it appear as if Africans are less intelligent, Africans are lazy, Africans are less worth than people from around the world. So we try to remind Africans of their true nature. The discussion we've had at the LSE summit about Africa and education, one thing I wanted to say was that, you see, a very good job has been done to make people, and to make Africans especially, to think that the history of Africa started with colonialism. People forget that Africa had a whole other history before colonialism, or even before slavery.
Lake Victoria was still there with an African name.
Exactly. Mount Kenya was there with an African name.
Exactly.
We had the Mosuitunya Falls, which they call Victoria Falls.
Mm-hmm.
They still existed. And even before that, we had the Ishango Bone, which proved that Africans used to do mathematics. We had the Rosetta Stone from Egypt. We had manuscripts in Timbuktu. And the center of learning was basically Africa. But what happened so that now the story is on its head, that people of African descent have to travel to the West to get an education, while in the past, people used to travel from wherever it is they came from in the world to Africa to learn. So we try and explain to people such stories, how things really work in the financial system, in the education system, in the geopolitical system, just trying to do the work that many people have shied away from. So we interpret news, we don't just report on the news. And this is something which has been sorely lacking in the media space. People just report what has happened instead of explaining to people where this story started, why is it happening now, and what does it mean for the future as an African-centered media house. So that's the role that African Stream has been playing.
It's pretty much amazing to see what you're doing. And of course, I've seen these problems within the media quite a lot, of course, as a practitioner. I'll never forget one day, we picked up a story at BBC World Service through the wires, as you call them, and they were talking about plane crash in Jomo Kenyatta International Airport in Nairobi. And the whole day they kept reporting about a plane crash, almost three quarters of the day, until I was like, but I didn't actually get someone to confirm it happened. And now within this media editorial newsroom, we are like, why don't you call someone to confirm whether it's true or not? And they just called at the airport and said, there's no plane crash. It was just a drill. So you just imagine what was going out as news, factual news, was a drill conducted at the airport for its own security in future and how to manage its own crisis, if that was ever to happen. And I've seen also another, I could go on so many examples. Yeah. In the UK, we have a very famous moment whereby one of the TV channels, Channel 4, followed up during the piracy, too much piracy by Somali pirates, and it was happening quite a lot. Channel 4, one of the journalists followed up what was being reported by the other media houses. And he followed up the source of the news. And he ended up finding out these guys based in somewhere in Nairobi were just actors. They were pretending to be real pirates. And they were being interviewed by your CNN and all these global media channels, a real pirates. Until this guy grilled them further. He said, what's the problem? We are actors, and we want the money from the West.
Wow.
So a big, documentary done known as Fake Pirates, mm-hmm. It spills everything that can go wrong.
Yeah.
You remember the post-election violence in Kenya after 2007?
Yes.
Yeah. And the Western media, again, they always thought, during election time, yeah, there are things we should expect. It may happen, may not, but young people knows what the Western media was thinking.
Yeah.
And I remember one day, just before elections, we had about five young people in Kibera area burning tires on the road. And they were saying, we're doing it for CNN. Yeah, we're doing it for the Western media. And these guys are filming that, and in a minute they're reporting, it's election time. Riots have started. War may be breaking out. So, even your ordinary folk can tell there's a problem.
Yes.
But you're a practitioner. You check these into details. How often do you come across situations like that? And yeah.
They happen all the time. They happen all the time. And you've stated it very correctly, the instances where Western media has been caught red-handed, sometimes paying even some of these people. You spoke of the 2007-2008 post-election violence. When the next cycle of election came in 2013, we had a CNN journalist, I can't remember her name, but she was filming people supposedly training for the upcoming violence, which wasn't even there. So later on it came out that, these people who are in the forests were actually just acting out their gimmicks for the CNN. And if they're making money out of it, fine, because this is something which a gullible media would only fall for. So we definitely try and go further in terms of journalistically making sure that we maintain that high standard of ethics, because even though we are African-centered, we are not lost to the fact that some people would want to create stories either to embarrass you in terms of your fact-checking, to discredit you, to say that if they got this story wrong, what's to say that they get everything wrong?
Yeah.
So every small infraction or any small error that you do, we really take it seriously in the newsroom at African Stream to make sure that it doesn't fester. So anytime we've had such situations, we apologize in the comment section and even pin the comments and say, you know, we apologize that we got such and such thing wrong. I could give an example of a story. I was in the DRC in December covering, you know, the situation in Eastern Congo. M23 has been waging attacks on Eastern Congo for a very long time. And there are fears that Goma, the biggest city in Eastern Congo, would fall to the M23. So I was doing a report and I did an analysis about, you know, approximately 6 million people have died, approximately 7 million have been displaced. And I was doing a PTC, you know, journalists we call it a PTC. Piece to camera. And I made an error about the numbers. It wasn't really about the numbers. I said, you know, the DR Congo has been said from multiple sources that it's one of the poorest countries in the world. Actually, I didn't say one of, I said the poorest. So by some metrics, yes, people have said the DRC is the poorest country in the world. However, it's in terms of GDP, and I didn't specify that. Right? So since I didn't specify that, when we did the actual story and it went out, I had to be called out and to be told, you know, come on, let's fix that.
Yeah.
Because everything you say as a journalist, every word, every fact, it has to be double, triple checked. And errors can be made because man is to error. However, we need to try as much as possible to minimize them so that even if they happen, the public understands that, okay, it was an oversight because they apologized in the comment section.
Yeah.
The problem is, and I wanted to ask, when these situations that you uncovered, that the BBC had covered and even Channel 4, did they apologize?
Funny enough, no.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
And you see, the worst thing about this is if an African media house did that, you know, to a story that was happening in the UK or France or the US,
they would be in trouble.
Exactly. You'd be in big trouble. Yeah. You'd be hung on the stake. Why?
Hmm.
Is it that there are different levels of, or the different thresholds that people are held to when they're talking about an African country, and then a different threshold when you're talking about a country in the West? It should be similar.
Should be similar.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah, no worries. I think, wow, you're doing great. And no, it's great having you. I think I would really make time to have a longer chat with you in a different setting. But for the purposes of this one, I think you'll leave it at that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah. I'll encourage people to follow African Stream. Yeah. Check us out on all social media platforms.
Yeah.
See you there.
Yeah, thank you.
Colorful radio. Colorful radio.
Governments, different parts of the world spend a lot of money to educate its people. It's people. And of course, in the world today, you cannot help to see the interconnectivity between different countries and different people. And of course, when it comes to serving the world, we talk about people working in different countries. But for African countries that really have meager resources, some of them, and also they go the extra mile to train their people, is it okay that they end up losing all those who qualify, most of them, to different countries in the Western Hemisphere, in the global society, who end up working in different countries. Is it really the right thing to do? Or what are the key issues when it comes to educating people and playing a role and making a difference in their own mother countries? What are the issues? Should people live within their country just because the government educated them so that they keep working, so that they make a difference? Is that the issue? What are the key issues? To explore this further, I'm happy to be joined by Nancy Masila. She's a financial expert. And of course, when we talk about diaspora, when we talk about issues of brain drain, issues of brain gain, which is which, I'm happy to be joined by Nancy Masila.
Colorful radio.
Great. Welcome to Africa in Focus. Of course, it's great to have you. Nancy Masila, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Julius.
Touching on a very serious issue, brain drain. And sometimes, as I'm always on the other side, I'm always looking for brain gain. I mean, what quickly comes to your thoughts when you think about brain drain, diaspora? And also our desire, like you, you're
yeah.
from Kenya, you've seen the president is trying to look for jobs for yeah. Kenyans away from Kenya.
Yeah, I think we need to refrain or kind of like restructure the conversation from just saying brain drain or brain gain. I think those are kind of like the discussions that were being made from other parts of the continent, and more so in the Western spaces. Because as we look at it, and like as I mentioned on the panel, currently the African population is at 1.4 billion. And out of that, we have close to around 200 million Africans in the diaspora. And you know, that's a drop in the ocean. So my question to the audience was, is it really a brain drain when we have an excess of talent? Again, on the African continent, the average age is 19 years old. And compare that with other places where the average age is 40 years old. So you can see kind of like the amount of talent we have on the African continent. And then another challenge I gave to the audience was, do we speak about brain drain because we are meeting Africans who are excelling in the spaces we are in and assuming that is the best that there is from the continent, whereas not even questioning, maybe this is just a section of the African excellence on the continent. Maybe the excellence is still on the African continent. So I think we need to restructure that. And in this time and age, I think we need to have better conversations and kind of like just think about this whole thing differently. And again, why do we kind of talk about brain drain when it comes to Africa, but then in other parts of the world, we are calling it...
Expatriates.
We're calling it, you know, championing or pioneering new markets. Like, you know, I think we do need to have a different outlook to that conversations, in my opinion.
I quite agree because I saw not long ago, I had a very interesting conversation with someone talking about diaspora remittances,
yeah.
which are huge.
Huge.
And then there was that conversation about brain drain again.
Mm.
So we need to send everyone, the good people, doctors and everyone, need to yeah. go to lift Africa up. And then he looked me on my face and said, who will be sending the money?
yeah.
So you see, both sides.
Yeah. And I like that you've touched on the remittances because currently, if I can give an example about Kenya, the Kenyan remittances is accounting for the top earners for foreign exchange and is actually at par with tea, coffee, horticulture, and tourism. Can you imagine? And years, 5-10 years ago, that was never a thing. And I think the Kenyan government has even gone a step forward into like even establishing the Ministry of Diaspora, trying to engage the diaspora. So there's a lot of positives that can be gotten from the diaspora. on the other side of that equation, and kind of like some of the reports that are coming from the Central Bank of Kenya, we are seeing that as much as there's a lot of money coming into the country through the diaspora remittances, a lot of it is going into household expenditures, things around allowances, giving money to our parents for healthcare, for schooling, or for building that small mansion you have in the village. So a lot of it is not actually going into development or investment. So I think it's great that a lot of the money is coming into the continent from the African diaspora, but I think we need to have better structures and better planning to ensure that the money goes into other avenues as well, like development and investment.
But if you talk about Kenya, for example, and diaspora, I don't think it's just sending money to our relatives, even. So they've gone a lot way beyond. There are some estates, for example, in Nairobi, outskirts of Nairobi, they are just purely built by Kenyans in the US, diaspora in other countries as well. If you go to coastal parts of Kenya, Voi, they are thinking of building a whole town built by Kenyans in the diaspora. Purely. Because, as you're saying, pretty much right, that there had to be a system to attract or to make this money not just to be help to your sibling, but go beyond to see change in the economy of the country. So I think they are doing that.
But I agree, Julius, and I agree. And I think those have been a lot of the efforts that the government has been doing, a lot of the efforts also in the private sector. So there are a lot of positives. And like I've said, the remittances has grown over the years, and again, there's a lot of diaspora engagement with even the investment companies, with the property companies coming over to overseas and trying to engage and showing Kenyans across the different you know, continents they're in, whether Europe or America, that, you know, you don't have to send money to your cousin or to your brother. You can actually invest in this, you know, estate that we have built. And I think that's great. And that's where we need to go. And hence, you know, building of the infrastructure to allow this.
And when you think about where they focus on mostly, it's like a situation whereby you have Kenyan nurses who take so many years to be trained. Another time, UK opens doors for Kenyan nurses. And in a minute, government signs a contract with UK government. They come to the UK, but absorption of the African skill in the West has always been controversial. A fully trained nurse working in Kenya, they have to go extra exams to be seen at par with a nurse working in the UK. What do you have to say about some of these arrangements? And is it really not brain drain? Because it takes a lot of money to train a nurse in Kenya. Would they not rather be absorbed within the Kenyan market? Because UK doesn't give equivalent to replace.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you that educating some of our top talent is expensive, both to the government, both to the citizen, because again, remember, these are, you know, citizens' taxes going into some of this education facilities. I agree that when, you know, the nurses and especially the health profession comes to this Western market, they are required to do additional exams or certifications. And I've spoken to nurses and doctors on the ground, and some of the sentiments they make is sometimes the equipment is different, so there might be actually a need for further training. But I think there have been conversations in certain spaces where they're saying, could we also take that Western training to the African continent, such that once you're trained, you can kind of work, you know, in any part of the world? And I think that makes sense. Questions around, you know, what then happens, we need to ask ourselves, as Kenya, as the African continent, do we have enough opportunities to absorb those graduates from the nursing schools, from the, you know, whatever sector that they're coming from? We need to really come and ask ourselves, do we have the enough opportunities, be it in Kenya, be it in other countries, and what can we do? I think, health sector aside, there are other industries where the point of entry into Western markets is easier. For example, if you look at tech, if you're a tech engineer in Kenya, you are a tech engineer in the US, you're a tech engineer in the UK. you don't really require like additional training. But again, we appreciate that tech is a particularly different sector compared to like healthcare. So I know some of the African government do try and push for like trade agreements for nurses and whatnot, and I think that's a low-hanging fruit because of like, you know, the need of nurses and health workers in different markets. But the different institutions should also try and put on the table other professions that may not be able to be absorbed in the different industries. People working in financial services, people working in tech, people working in education, people working in engineering. There's so many different industries that the different institutions can kind of engage and support in whichever format, you know, to get out there. And the kind of barriers of entry are very, very limited, if any.
Yeah, I think you have a point there. So which way? Now, mm-hmm. Brain drain or no brain drain? Which one do you support?
I think it's not a black and white sort of question or answer. I think for me, I stand with collaboration. I think we need to have collaboration and engagement because talent will always go where it's rewarded. Let's be real. We're in the 21st century. Wherever the reward is the highest, talent will follow. So we need to come up with a solution. Okay. And also, do we have enough resources, opportunities, and infrastructure to absorb people coming from the universities? If you're being honest with ourselves, no. The rate of unemployment on the African continent is quite high. We simply cannot be able to absorb all the talent that there is in Africa. So we need to look at a situation where we're collaborating with other nations and see how we can help our youth coming from the universities and how we can also maintain the talent and kind of like maybe make it circular. Yes, some are leaving, some are coming back. And, you know, the people that leave, they are free ambassadors to those nations. Your Obamas, your Lupita Nyong'os, you know, those are people from the continent kind of spreading the word about, you know, Kenya, for example, Afrobeats, you know, it's from Africa.
Yeah.
I'm a piano. Tyler won Grammys. Like, you know, I think we're at a point where we're a global society and we need to appreciate that. And I think also other countries across the world have done the same. They have their people moving left, right, and center. Look at India. Like, Rishi has roots from, I mean, Kenya, but, you know, India as well. Microsoft, Indians are over there. Like, we need to appreciate that humans are moving and they will
move. More R&B classics coming up on Colorful Radio. We are not.
Make me swim, make me harder, make me lose my breath, make me water, make me swim, make me harder. Make me lose my breath, make me water.
Normally, I could keep my cool, but tonight I'm whining. I'm a bee in a dangerous mood, can you match my timing? Telling me that you're really about it, what you're hiding. Talk is cheap. So show me that you understand how I like it. Can you blow my mind? Set off my whole body. If I give you my time, can you search my soul from it? I don't wanna wait. I'm taking, take me where I ain't been before. Can you blow my mind? Can you blow my mind?
In love with the madness.